Get ready to leave a vibration with this live transmission. To all sports, travelers, visionaries, artists, free thinkers, and learned beings across the globe, it's time to change our world.
What's up, Evolver Planet? Welcome to the show. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Jonah Bolden. With us, as always, on the show is co-host Aaron Shaw.
Hey, thanks for tuning in, Evolver Planet Radio. Today's Friday, March 16th, 2012.
And on the show tonight, we have Tara from Evolver Salt Lake City giving us a spore update and also an interview with Mandy Kahn, author, and also examining the 21st century's identity. Check out collageculture.com.
And we'll hear an interview with Nishe Chanal, co-founder of the Psychedemia Conference and contributing editor to Reality Sandwich.
And with that, let's jump into a Spore City update with Tara. Tara, thanks so much for coming on the show. How you doing?
Hi, good, thanks.
Excellent. So first, give us an update on what's been going on in Salt Lake City.
All right. Well, coming up in the next week on the 26th, actually, 26th of March, which is a Monday, we're going to have a night called Come Together, where we'll gather at the Salt Lake Bike Collective to talk about how bicycling works as a sustainable model inside of Salt Lake City. It's something that I tried for a summer, but then I ended up working 50 miles away, so it works for local travel. We have other Come Together activities going on as well. It's always on evolver.net. You can find everything that's happening in the city right away, right there. There's regular yoga happening with Kushner at the Krishna Center every week on Wednesdays and Thursdays, and also at Dancing Crane. That's some of the actual activities.
And Tara, let's ask, how did you first get involved with Evolver? When was your first Evolver experience?
Oh, let's see. I think it was like 2008 or 2009, and I went to a presentation on a new economic model that a person, Floyd, was putting together at the time with this guy, Ron. And I can almost remember the film they showed, but they actually kind of stopped the movie sort of halfway through because they'd seen it before, and I hadn't seen it, but they, anyway. So it was this funny night of getting together and talking about a different sense of economy. I had been to that thing in the desert and visited Enthian Village, Burning Man. I'd been out there and visited Enthian Village and had a sense that maybe this Evolver stuff kind of tied in with some of that. So I was interested in that and heard that Evolver was having a meeting. And I was also interested in seeing, what an alternate economy could look like in this case. I think they were hinting towards the gift economy or, time banks and those sorts of ideas. And so that was then. And since then, I've helped organize, around 10 or more events a year on a monthly basis. And then a few other random, volunteer things that I've done with Reality Sandwich and so on. So most recently, we've been screening independent documentaries, and that's been great because of the, you know, films and communities and cultures that brings Salt Lake City in touch with. So.
And how's the in Salt Lake City? When I think of Salt Lake City, I think of, like, really remote and, you know, back in time, and Evolver is a very conscious, spiritual group. How has the response been out there?
Oh. Salt Lake City is founded by a group of people who have no problem with striking out on their own in terms of defining themselves spiritually and socially. The Mormon pioneers and so on who established the valley as far as, like, white person goes. I mean, there were native cultures here before Mormons, but those Mormons were actually coming out to the West specifically to form their own culture, to live by their own rules, and to have their own religion. So, kind of coming from that spirit, it's not hard to find people who maybe are no longer working with those traditions, Mormonism, or, you know, there's tons of different forms of religion and Christianity in Utah, but now they're working with their own sense of identity, but they can fuse very deeply with the sense of spirituality and social movements, and so you'd be surprised. It's kind of a long and wandering answer, but I think you'll find Salt Lake has a lot of really creative people. It was actually listed as a bohemian town because you find lawyers who play the saxophone, and everybody loves to go to the ballet, and, you know, everyone who has one profession as an accountant might also be a painter. It's a very creative, expressive town with a lot of openness and interest in what's going on in the world, even if, you know, even people might stay in their ways, but just still.
Oh, yeah, that's really interesting how you have the nice mix of spiritual traditions in the background. So does that mean that you also have groups to collaborate with? Do you tend to reach out to other groups in Salt Lake, or is Evolver sort of a hub for that kind of, interest?
I would say there are many, many different groups that we can reach out to, and in fact, in the next month, you know, one of my focus areas is in the theme of coming together to get more involved with some of the other groups that are out there. There's actually so much going on in Salt Lake that even though ultimately it's a small little fishbowl, and people always joke about how you think it gets big and then you find out that someone you never met was actually your best friend's best friend. But there's a lot of groups out there. There's a lot of people that are working. There's the Peace Alliance, who's a really active chapter here. Peace Up has a lot going on out here. The group that we're tying in with for our next board, the Salt Lake Bicycle Collective, they're really close to a vegan diner called Vertical Cafe. And that diner is something that has grown out of the intentions of its owner, or his owner, who is Ian. And he has done so much for organic food and sustainable food movements in Salt Lake. He's also the proprietor of Cali's Natural Foods, which is an organic place. There's tons and tons going on, and the community here is vast. I can think of, you know, at least 1,000 people off the top of my head, and I'm just one person in Salt Lake, you know, and I can think of at least 1,000 people who are also organizing and moving and have their own circles and are working with other people in their community. It's a very active town in that sense, and, you know, and I think, too, just, you know, kind of going back to that cultural root, people are very into self-sustainability. They're very into communal effort. Mm-hmm. It's part of the natural culture of the place, you know? So.
Right. And so what? Nice. How would you like the Spore to grow, or how would you like the Evolver community, or just the Salt Lake City community, to grow in the next few mm-hmm. years? What would you like to see for it?
I would love to see Evolver have a more outward presence in Salt Lake City, to where, it's just maybe more common knowledge of what Evolver.net is and how Salt Lake, and in that sense, to see, the outward presence is a place where people can come to conscious events and know that if it says Evolver, it's a place where they're going to find like minds, so they can have common conversations. And you can keep it as, you can speak about the earth in every context. So if you'd like to speak about organic gardening, that's great. If you'd like to study the sky and speak about it in celestial terms, you know, and relate it to the sun and other planets, that's equally good. If you want to just talk about hand-to-hand and heart-to-heart connections and meet with other people who want to have those genuine connected moments, that's also fine, you know. And so that's kind of where I see Evolver Salt Lake going, is just all of those components exist in our society and community now. And so just creating Evolver as a safe space to propagate and grow that more and bring it together.
And have you guys been doing anything to be more active with the community to help transform the community? Are you guys engaged in any projects like that?
There are lots of Evolvers in Salt Lake City who are working on their own projects of that nature, and we're working together with each other on those projects. But as far as having a specific Evolver project, like this is the Evolver project, that is something that I think is in our close future. One thing that I'm very excited about is the notion of the Evolver nodes, which would be like having actual sort of Evolver centers or homes, or maybe like an Evolver, I don't know about office, but like a center, you know, just something where people can come and get more information, but also have practical experience. You know, maybe an Evolver house where we actually have a communal space, a communal garden, and are working on that functioning sustainable model, working with the way that Daniel Pinchbeck, I think, relates to permaculture in the 2012 Time for Change sense, where we're using our human ingenuity and our creativity and all of our craftiness to make technologies that are working with the natural biology of the earth, to make earthy technologies. I mean, you know, to make things that biodegrade and allow us to have our human forms and be humans and still within ourselves here, but still be smart and progressive and making stuff, because that's what we like to do too. So,
absolutely.
Is that too far out? Like, if for the immediate future, I just think focusing on, yeah.
That is so awesome.
I think, yeah.
So, and what are also some things that you guys have been doing to really engage more active members? What are some tips you can give some other spore groups of how you guys have been active in recruiting new members to join your spore group?
Just keep your points of contact really relevant. So, you know, you had a great event and people are interested in more information. And so how they come to have information is by usually sharing their contact information with you. So when you're reaching out to them again, just be sure to be very respectful of the communication that's happening there, and stay focused to the purpose of Evolver or the purpose of your project that you're connecting through. So you know, when you have them on an email list, you know, be conscious about how you share that list and be sure that you are sending them information when it's relevant. Like, hey, this is happening and it's coming up right now, so they can get involved. And then if someone steps up and wants to do something, you know, give them the assistance they need, if they need any at all, and then help to facilitate them just going off and doing it. I mean, the more people who are actually actively working on this change, the more likely it is to continue to happen. You know, it takes hands to make things work. So,
absolutely. Cool.
Yeah.
And you had more questions?
No, that just sounds so awesome.
Yeah, it sounds like you guys are doing a lot of work.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's a great community, and it's nice to .net, you know, resource to be able to speak through the nation and kind of relate with others who are working on the same projects. And yeah, so we'll stay in touch with what's happening locally. Looking forward to seeing what the next year brings. And everything feels so completely dynamic right now that it's strange to really think more than a few weeks ahead, you know. But
yeah. I struggle with that myself sometimes. Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on the show, and I'm sure that we'll be having you back on in this next year to give us some more updates on how you guys are doing. And, of course, just send out some light and love for Evolver Planet Radio, and help us get the word out there. And we support you guys, and you're doing amazing work. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks, Tara.
Thanks so much. Thank you. Thanks so much, Evolver Planet Radio. Nice job.
Thanks. You have a good night. And with that, we'll take a quick break and listen to some more DJ Scalar while we bring in our next guest, Mandy Kahn.
Okay, Sam, I'm taking the headphones up. Welcome back to Evolver Planet Radio. Now joining us on the show is Mandy Kahn, author of Collage Culture, Examining the 21st Century's Identity from collageculture.com. Mandy, thanks for coming on the show. How you doing?
Oh, I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. So first jump into your awesome website and what it's all about.
Well, the website really just exists to support the book and tell people about the book. The book came out in the fall. It came out a month earlier in Europe than it did in the States. So my co-author, Aaron Rose, and I, and our graphic designer, because the book is laid out in a really unusual graphic design with a sort of unusual look. Our graphic designer, Brian Rodinger, the three of us went to Europe. I was there for a month, talking about the book, and then came back to the States to talk about it. So we were in Europe in October. It came out It came out a little later officially in Europe, and then it came out in December in the States. It's also now actually just coming out as a record, which is unusual for a work of heavy-hitting nonfiction to also come out as a record. And it's the record combines readings of like 30 different people that we know and that are friends with, reading chunks of the book, combined with an original score by the band No Age. And it came out on vinyl last week.
Wow.
It's really unusual for nonfiction, but we were looking to do something really unexpected.
So can you tell us, what is collage culture? Where does that title come from?
That title actually came from the first, you know, conversation that Aaron Rose, my co-writer, and I ever had about the book, which actually happened here in Los Angeles at the Bright Spot restaurant in Echo Park, where I think all ideas begin. Aaron and I were having dinner with a bunch of other people as well, and I was sort of pitching him my idea about how we are all living in this, you know, highly collaged cultural landscape, this essentially that we've stumbled into this period of collage culture, and I was sort of explaining my idea. And then Aaron called me or emailed me a week later and said, you know, I can't stop thinking about that idea. Do you maybe want to do a book together? And so the idea essentially is, you know, the process of making collaged art, the process of hunting through things, finding things that you like, cutting them up, taking small pieces of them, combining them, and then saying, that's my work of art, which is just essentially a combination of cut up parts of other things. That process in the 21st century is the process that we use to make art across cultural forms, everything from music to literature to interior design to fashion design to fine art and jewelry design. And what used to be creation, you know, the idea of sort of making something from scratch, almost seems passé now. We do so much hunting through things from the 20th century, picking favorites, cutting, combining, and that it almost seems like the process of creation has had this shift from, you know, making from scratch to essentially collaging. And so we sort of examine how we got to this sort of highly collaged cultural landscape, and is that forever or is it sort of temporary, and what does it say about us, and mostly how does it feel to live in this like highly collaged world?
One of the favorite themes that you had in your essay, Living in the Mess, is about tone. Can you tell me about, or share a little bit about, like, what you mean by tone in the context of collage culture, where, you know, it's how you juxtapose something that previously existed? You know, what is tone in these terms?
A simple way to think about this is you think of a work of art that is complete and made from scratch. Like, think of something like the Mona Lisa. And you stand in front of the Mona Lisa, and there's a feeling there. You know, the picture has a tone, and there's meaning there. And let's take the process that we use now, this sort of collaging, and imagine a work where you cut out just her face or just her hand, and you combine it with just the face or the hands or some parts of, you know, photocopied versions of other great works of art. And then you combine them into this thing that has, you know, basically chunks of other works of art, where you've essentially taken whatever sort of the meaning and the tone of the original piece was, you've taken a piece of it, and when you removed it, you've essentially removed that original tone, and now it's kind of just a symbol or a chunk. And then you have this collaged work, and then next thing you know, there's another artist that comes along and takes that collaged work and cuts that up and uses those, you know, parts as just chunks. And what you have, you end up with these sort of meaningless symbols, these disembodied chunks, essentially, that don't have the the same tone as the original piece, and they don't have the same meaning as the original piece. And it's a, you know, it's a harmless act. And yet when you're living in this cultural landscape that's so highly collaged, you have this loss of meaning and loss of tone happening so frequently that you start to feel like you're living in this landscape of meaningless symbols, this landscape where you can't determine the tone of anything. And you just sort of end up with these, you know, symbols that kind of stop meaning anything.
Right. It made me wonder, you know, one of the first conversations we had about this book, I was thinking, you know, in a way this reminds me of the thought that, you know, everything is derivative and therefore there should be, you know, sort of open source intellectual property attitudes so that you have free access to things and you can then build upon them and mix your labor with previous existing ideas. And that sounds all well and good. And then also at the same time, you make reference to seasickness in your essay about how jolting it is to see such a mash of, you know, say like 50s dresses are back in the same time that all these like 70s furniture is back in style. And, you know, as somebody who did not live through the 70s, was born in the 80s and didn't even become aware of culture really until the 90s, it's just really, I also wonder how my older people experience collage culture differently, having gone through those decades when that was the cutting edge. Obviously, this book, you know, this essay and book sends mine all sorts of different directions. But maybe you could speak to the metaphor of seasickness.
Yeah. So I realize, and I should start by saying that I have a very sort of sensitive system for that. I've always been a person who gets seasick, and so I'm always sort of very interested in whether my body, and seasickness happens when your body is essentially getting two clashing pieces of information. So when your eyes see that, you know, the landscape looks flat, but your body feels that you're bumping all around, that those two dissimilar pieces of information meet in your brain, and your brain goes into this sort of like does not compute mode, and it makes you physically sick. So looking around this highly collaged cultural landscape that happened in the 21st century, where suddenly there's a fashion revival of the 60s, and then the next week there's a fashion revival of the 70s, and the next week there's a fashion revival of the 20s, and you know, you walk into a contemporary party and there's someone dressed like it's the 1940s right next to someone who's dressed just like it's the 1950s, and you essentially are drawing dissimilar pieces of information potentially. I was sort of interested in that idea, so I spoke with a researcher at the Center for Perceptual Systems at UT Austin, which is sort of the premier sort of place where informational processing is sort of being studied and discussed, and basically said, look, you know, based on how seasickness works, is it possible that these sort of dissimilar pieces of information locating us in time might have a similar effect on the body? And the researcher who's a scientist, it's always interesting to talk with scientists because they're so specific in what they can agree or not agree to. But basically, which is actually, it's really fun to transcribe those tapes for that reason. But anyway, it's basically what he said was, you know, it is entirely possible that getting those two dissimilar pieces of information could result in a sort of seasickness, which was kind of, for me, in researching the book and talking to people as I was putting the essay together, that was kind of a light bulb moment for me, because I had come to the idea by essentially having that seasickness feeling, not all the time, but just having that feeling there's the feeling in the 21st century of being overwhelmed that I think, you know, can easily be traced to the fact that we just see more things because we're on the computer all the time than we ever have before. But for me, it felt like maybe there was something else going on. I felt like just the amount of information we see now maybe might not be the whole explanation for that sort of not just overwhelmed feeling, but I felt like it was harder now for my brain to sort of process information than it had been in the past, which is why I wanted to start talking to specialists. So the process of writing the essay for me was kind of a process of research and discovery, not having a science background myself. That was, really fun to do.
And when did the three of you, how long ago did the three of you come together and come up with this concept, and how did it grow? How long did it take you to manifest the full project?
So again, with Aaron and I mean, it was that the conversation that happened at the Bright Spot in Echo Park in LA, and then, you know, I got the email from him saying, would you maybe want to do a book on this together, and immediately said yes. And then in our first conversations, we had, you know, a couple of long conversations where we said, well, what would this book look like? And the first two decisions we made, the first decision we made was, well, let's write the book in two halves so we can sort of put forward our dissimilar points of view. Not that we, you know, particularly diverge, but we wanted to use our own voices and not do a book that we had written together where, you know, our texts were meshed or anything. So the first half is an essay that I wrote, and the second half is a long essay that Aaron wrote. But then the next decision we made was, we don't want this to feel academic. We don't want it to feel, intimidating to our potential reader, because we want this to fall in the hands of readers maybe that don't read nonfiction, and certainly who aren't academics, and certainly, people that we consider our peers, you know, musicians and, some of whom maybe don't even read one nonfiction title a year. So we really wanted it to feel different and to look different. And that's when we got the idea to call upon Brian Rodinger, who is a graphic designer we both admire just, you know, as much as you can admire someone's work. And basically bring him on as a collaborator to say, how can we lay the text out so that the book looks incredibly approachable, and it doesn't look academic, and it doesn't feel like, something that would, you know, be potentially intimidating. It looks kind of like, wow, what in the world is this? And so he kind of laid it out so that some of the pages look like posters. And we kind of gave him free rein to do whatever he wanted to do with the text. And so the book it just doesn't look like anything else in the bookstore when you flip through it. But that was sort of how we wanted it. We knew that we wanted it to fall into the hands of people that, you know, where it wouldn't end up unless there was something really weird about it.
Nice.
And I think that's where the record came into play as well, because again, the ideas were important to us. Aaron's part of the book is very much a call to arms to the next generation of creatives to return to creating from scratch, and he sort of makes an argument as to why he believes that creation from scratch is valuable and should sort of be returned to centrally how things are made. And that was really important for him to talk about, and my process felt really important to me to be able to talk to people about. And so the idea of working with a band to create a record that, you know, brought the text into the hands of people who in no shape would ever, you know, read the book version was also another way to just sort of like launch it out into the universe.
And what has the response been? I'm sure you've been talking to people and you've been all over the country and the world. What has the response been from people?
Well, I think, you know, what was most important to Aaron and I and what we always said was, you know, if it fosters any sort of a conversation, we're happy. So dissent, we are all for. I don't get so much of it. I think because my half is sort of an exploration and examination as much as anything. He takes a really strong stance, and so he runs into more people that say, you know, I disagree with you. He told me once that he gets about 80% of the people that he runs into regarding the project will say, I just, you know, thank you for writing this. I totally agree with what you said. And then 20% of people will say, I disagree and here's my argument, which means that 100% of the time he's happy about it because it's either, you know, either way it's fostering a discussion. So that's been his, you know, percentage breakdown of, you know, dissent versus agreement.
There you go. Excellent. And do you have any upcoming book tours and stuff like that going on? What's some upcoming events you guys are doing?
You know, we don't have dates set, but yes, we are, hopefully, the band No Age wants to do a live show that we've been talking to them about doing, which will work out if everybody's schedules permit, which would be them playing the score that they created to go with the book for the record at the same time that parts of the text are being read. So it would be sort of like a live performance of the record. And that is on the horizon, though a date is not set. And then there's another couple of live things that are on the horizon, but dates are not yet set for those. But yeah, I think we'll probably do a few. There's one that's a panel in which we essentially debate the ideas that's on the horizon for this year.
Wow. Well, Mandy, you also do your own poetry nights around L.A. Do you have anything upcoming apart from Collage Culture?
I have a reading on May 17th at Bergamot Station, which is a poetry reading. I have a reading on May 31st that actually is a couple of poetry installations that I put together where it's a whole bunch of poets that I've curated that read their work in sort of an unusual way as part of installations rather than the way that poetry readings usually are, where it's one person reads for 10 minutes and then another person reads for 10 minutes. I sort of wanted to mechanize that process so it felt more fluid and more exciting and engaging for the audience. And so I have sort of over the last 6 months been reimagining how a poetry reading might go. Just sort of, it's not such a different process from Aaron and I saying, how do we make, you know, this nonfiction work look different and feel more accessible? I'm sort of trying to do that with the format that poetry readings tend to happen. And so I've created these sort of like moving installations where you get to see a handful of poets read their work, but in a more sort of hopefully engaging or integrated or fluid way. Anyway, the last bookstore in downtown Los Angeles on May 31st will have these two moving poetry installations on a night that I curated and put together, and I'll be reading as well.
Excellent. All right, so awesome. It's collageculture.com, and I think that's the only
site. Examining the 21st century. Well, Mandy, thank you so much for coming on the air, and hope to have you back later on this year and give us an update on how the book and everything else is going.
Well, thank you guys so much for having me. It's my first Skype call ever, my first podcast ever. So many firsts. I have to call my parents and give them all the news. But thank you guys so much for having me.
All right. Thanks for being on,
Absolutely.
Mandy.
Sounded good. And with that, we'll take a quick break and listen to a little bit more of DJ Scalar. When we come back, we have one more interview. Enjoy. Welcome back to Evolver Planet Radio. That was an awesome interview from Mandy Khan. Thanks again for coming on the show. And now joining us on the line and on the air is Nessie Soul. How are you?
Hey, good. How are you? And I'm Say, and I'm here with Becky Lee also.
Bonjour. Hello.
Becky, how you doing?
Great. How are you?
Great. Thank you for coming on. All right, so first let's jump into, first talk about the biggest thing that you're working on, which is the, being the co-founder of the Psychedemia organization. Tell the listeners a little bit about that and how you first got involved with it.
We're just organizing a psychedelics conference at the University of Pennsylvania.
Which I coined the term psychedemia.
Yeah, psychedemia is like a mixture of psychedelic and academia. We had the idea originally because I've been going to a lot of psychedelic conferences around the world, and a lot of them are very science focused, which is, I mean, really important, but there's also a lot of other issues related to the psychedelic experience that I felt weren't being adequately addressed by just talking about science. So I thought that having a like radically interdisciplinary conference combining the science with the culture, with the art and the philosophy, and turning it towards the future and like where we can go from here would be a really good, important, timely thing to do.
Wow, okay. Well, so, I mean, I definitely want to hear more about the conference, but let's backtrack a little bit to how did you come to study psychedelics in an academic setting? Is that, the question goes out to both of you since you're co-organizers of Psychedemia at University of Pennsylvania, right?
Yeah, well, I'm in a comparative literature PhD program at Penn, and comparative literature originally was a, like, looking at different literatures together, so, like, English and Russian and German, but over time, it also came to mean interdisciplinary, so comparing, because what I do is kind of a mixture of literature and philosophy, art history, comparative religion, and anthropology, so... the program structure itself is very flexible because people who work inside comparative literature are doing really different things from each other. And so as long as your advisor basically like signs off on what you're doing, you can do whatever you want. And I originally came here to study mystical, romantic, visionary poetry, which is what I'm still working on. But when I first applied, I didn't know that, because I had this experience when I was an undergrad at Bard College that I was temporarily kicked out of school when I was introduced to acid, and the experience though was really meaningful and they let me back, but I couldn't like forget the experience, and so but I didn't know that I could be open about like my interests, so I was kind of vicariously talking about the ideas that I was interested in because of psychedelics through the romantic and the visionary poetry. Mm-hmm. So, but then when I realized, I read a New York Times article about the MAPS conference that happened in 2010 in San Jose, I think. And then I went to the Horizons conference in 2010 in New York City, and I saw this whole science psychedelic renaissance happening. And I realized, like, I had this vision at the time that I was standing in Horizons in 2010. I had this vision of how I could use like this, you know, the science coming back after so many decades of prohibition as an opportunity to bring up a lot of the other issues that also have been pushed out of the limelight. So it seemed like a really good time, a really good opportunity, and I just kind of ran with it. And my advisor is just really supportive. He's a poet. He's like a really famous and brilliant poet. So he never actually went to grad school himself. So, and he's really into kind of like working inside the system to, you know, get outside the system kind of thing. And so he's like really, so having him support me is really great because he's like, he's able to speak on behalf of my project to the other people in the academic world.
And translate.
Yeah.
Right, that was another of my main questions, is how is this received by both communities? I mean, if the point of psychedemia is to bring together academic communities and psychedelic communities around psychedelic culture, is there any resistance? Have you seen it ease over time? What's the reception like in the academic world?
Well, when I applied to bring my students to Horizons last year in 2011, and the academic dean of undergrads at Penn, he considered it, but then he looked at Horizons website and said that what he thought was an academic conversation about psychedelics was actually more, this is his quote, more advocacy than critical reflection. And I was just like really confused about that because the whole point of Horizons was to have an academic, like a legitimately academic conference about psychedelics. And looking at the people who were speaking, and like all of them, almost all of them had PhDs, and like they were, you know, so I was just kind of confused about why that seemed like what, in what context for him could you have a conference that was not advocacy? So, I mean, fortunately, I'm not working through the undergraduate academic dean to create this conference. We've been working with a lot of different faculty and neuroscience and other departments at Penn who just really, really believe in the importance of having this conversation, and they think it's the perfect time for it. And there's a lot of people who, like, you wouldn't necessarily think would be, because it's like what they study is not explicitly related to psychedelics, but they're actually like really big like advocates for having a conversation that hasn't been hasn't been the focus of academic attention in the past. Discourse. Like, yeah,
especially with giving credence to Steve Jobs's public statement about how LSD helped him create Apple. You know that it was like essential for his innovative creations. So, I mean, you could see how there might be some tension, especially with the recent Drexel LSD bust that took place in Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah, because Drexel is right next to Penn. Like, literally, like, a block over, you get to Drexel University, and there was a huge acid bust there. Like, supposedly $4 million of acid just a few weeks ago. So, it is kind of like a strange, because what did the person say about, higher education, LSD?
Oh, the district attorney of Philadelphia, Seth Williams' statement on the Drexel LSD bust was that it was, a shame to see something like this happening on a campus of higher learning, and that he would hope that the actions of a few won't tarnish the educational and academic excellence we associate with Drexel University. But, there's kind of like an irony there with respect to what Steve Jobs was saying about how the psychedelic experience, how like tapping into that state actually was like the gateway for his innovative creations.
So the district attorney basically saying that acid and higher education are incompatible is kind of ironic that next door we're having this, gigantic psychedelic conference, like only, a few months down the road. So, but I really do think that this is like, I want the vision for it is to bring together different groups that would not normally communicate. Like some people who are like heavily entrenched in the academic world and don't really like, aren't really exposed to much that's going on, like psychedelic culture and stuff like that. And people who are in the culture and, part of the visionary art movement or, any of that. And to be able to have a conversation, bringing them into just see what happens when we raise the question that, what's the value of these experiences in 2012, it's at this moment in time. And so, so it's basically just like an experimental platform for a conversation that has been waiting for a long time to happen.
And that's one of the things I want to ask both of you, because talking about 2012, the transformation, the shift of consciousness, it's happening all around us, and psychedelics obviously for many of us have opened up doorways in different dimensions to see different truths. What do you guys personally think is going to happen this year? Just your own intuitiveness of what's happening with the transformation of the planet. What do you see happening with the conscious shift of humanity here?
Well, I feel like, there was the Mayan prophecy of the 2012 paradigm shift, which is, perhaps fortuitous. But at the same time, it sort of makes sense because of the technological evolution of our society in just the last, the last century. Because for centuries and centuries, mankind was without, cars, oil, any kind of electricity. This is really a recent thing. The electric element of life is a more recent thing.
Well, and what I really liked about Terrence McKenna talking about 2012, there's this one Reality Sandwich article. I forget what the title of the article was, but it was someone who was recounting a conversation he'd had with Terrence, and he said, Terrence said that even if, 2012 wasn't supposed to, wasn't automatically going to be this huge, unwrapping of a present or something, just him making this big commotion about it and having everyone be like, oh, wow, 2012, that could actually create the thing. So it's, this performance of what, in saying it, you're doing it. It's not
it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah. So I feel like this is an opportunity, the same way that I said that, when I saw the psychedelic science renaissance as an opportunity for me to come in and take what I was good at and have, bring it into the culture and the philosophy side of the conversation, we can just use the opportunities we have around us, use 2012 as an opportunity, as an excuse to just take things to the next level and really treat the world and each other seriously, take ourselves seriously for how, like, how much potential we actually have.
And how precious life is.
Yeah. So I think that, but I really am, I refer to myself as a pathological optimist, because I really have a lot of faith in my generation. I feel like people are really, there's just like this energy that's brimming, and people just really feel like they want to just like come forward and like, you know, really get involved in community and building things and making the world a better place. And
especially because of the increase in the technological developments, because now there are all these synchronicities happening more and more rapidly, and it seems like people are becoming like more psychically connected. And then this has been like exhibited in experiments conducted by Dean Radin and the Global Consciousness Research Project, which monitors a person's abilities to affect a random generator, like a random coin generator. So a lot of like religious and scientific fields of thinking are like coming together now.
Yeah. It's amazing.
So can you share some of the panel topics for Psychedemia? I mean, you cover art, science, lots of different things. What can we expect to hear at the Psychedemia conference?
Shamanism.
Yeah, well, yeah. So we're hoping to get the teams at Johns Hopkins and NYU doing the psilocybin for, in the case of NYU, they're doing the cancer anxiety with psilocybin, and the Johns Hopkins teams to come and present their work and the latest findings and where they see their work going. And then we also, but for this conference, like a lot of the other conferences are very science focused. So we wanted to make a point to have this conference really like emphasize the cultural components as well. So have like we're going to be bringing a lot of visionary artists in, and because the visionary art, that movement is so historically significant, like in the context of art history and philosophy, because the whole postmodern, like, just the
mentality,
yeah, the of like constantly deferring meaning and irony and all that, it's like completely antithetical to the visionary project, where art is this like world creating, perspective forming, like optimistic kind of like, yeah. So the same way that, so it's really timely. And I think it's really amazing that I am in the literature program, but I'm like one of like, I don't know of any other people who are getting their PhDs studying visionary art. So, but this is, so basically we felt like this was something that we should be bringing into the academy more, and seeing what the significance of visionary art is in relation to art history. So, but yeah, bringing in also anthropology, and we have an open call for papers. So anyone who is interested and has like an academic perspective on, you know, something related to the psychedelic question, then, you know, we're trying to have as well-rounded a conference as possible.
And, you know, that could really, like, trailblaze a whole new academic paradigm in which people are more, like, aware of the multidisciplinary aspects of their research and their studies, so that, you know, they can have a better idea of what's going on in general in an effort to, like, say, come up with a unifying theory, you know?
That's one thing that's really interesting about psychedelics, is, like, you cannot talk about psychedelics without talking about it from all these different directions. Like, even the science, like, the experiments they're doing, they even having like a hospital room, like they have to make it like really comfortable inside, and like have like music and like set the so that you can't separate like the things that you can measure like from the culture and from different, it, basically psychedelics is something that crosses boundaries, dissolves boundaries, and so
and
it's
that's a
really
problem with the science world too, because of, you know, Heisenberg uncertainty principle and the paradoxical nature of particles and waves, you know, in their manifestations as particles and waves.
So I just see psychedelic studies as potentially like a new, because people, like, how people can study, like, queer studies and how it's that interdisciplinary, like, I want to see that in the future, like, psychedelic studies as being, like, this interdisciplinary field that people in all sorts of departments can be a part of and contribute to. And hopefully one day I'll be a professor at a school and be able to oversee, like, a psychedelic studies minor for some of the students that I'm teaching, and that's kind of, like, my goal.
Wow, I love that trailblazing effort. Very cool.
Excellent. Well, the event is coming up in October, and you said there's other ways.
The very end of September, the last weekend. And so psychedemia.org is the website. It has all the information. And we also have a Facebook page, facebook.com/psychedemia.
You're still looking for people to be involved in.
We are very actively all summer long. We are going to be putting this thing together, and we wanted to be like a really it's a really grassroots labor of love. It's not just a few people standing in a room talking at each other. It's going to be there's going to be art. People are going to be
it's a networking opportunity
Basically, anyone who feels drawn to this, we encourage to contact us and contribute however they feel that they can best contribute. And,
And it seems the recent studies showing that psychedelics have had unusually beneficial effects in treating, alcohol, heroin addiction and withdrawal symptoms, which is, quite a battle.
And one thing I did want to mention is that we're going to be doing a Kickstarter soon to help fundraise for us, because this is, I emphasize, really grassroots. We're a lot of, graduate students are putting this together, because MAPS in the past year recently started sponsoring a graduate student association, so that graduate students who are working on psychedelic issues all over the world now have a way to communicate and network. And this really grew out of that. This conference grew out of that new possibility that we had together. So it's a lot of students who are working on it together and other people who are just feel passionately about it. So we're going to do everything we can to make it as awesome as we can. So we think this is a really great opportunity. If you think about it, the 60s is associated with Harvard and Timothy Leary from the academic perspective. So I kind of think it's symbolically significant that it's coming back to the University of Pennsylvania, because that's an Ivy League school too, but it's a joke that I have to myself, is the Ivy without an ego. It doesn't have a name, the Harvard and that. And so it's appropriate that's coming back to Penn, and this is a really great opportunity, because people pay attention to the Ivy Leagues, and the fact that the Ivy Leagues are going to have a psychedelic conference means that eyes are going to be turned on this thing that's happening in 2012. So there's a lot of potential here for to actually leave a really indelible mark on the world. And so people have been coming to us and just being wow, how can we get involved? And we're just encouraging anyone who feels passionately about it to come help us make it more awesome.
Yeah, that was my motivation for volunteering to help out, because I feel overall it could really be beneficial for the gateway to the panacea for the social ailments that plague the nation, cognitive dissonance and, self-righteous attitudes that tear people apart, because the psychedelic experience and experiment shows to have more unifying effect and with the entanglement theory, which has recently emerged, showing that people are interconnected even on a metaphysical realm. It seems the multidisciplinary aspects of it are germane because of how it's this whole process is exhibiting a pattern which is perceivable in all fields.
Well, thank you both for coming on the air and on the show, and we'll definitely be talking about it for all the spores and all the listeners out there. Check out psychedemia.org and get involved, and amazing conference coming up. So thank you guys so much for putting this together. It's amazing work you're doing.
Yeah, thank you. It was good to talk.
Excellent. And with that, we're going to take we don't have time for a break, so we're just going to do a little wrap-up here. And Aaron, tell us what's coming up.
All right, so joining us next week, Friday, March 23rd, we'll have music artist Hope Griffin, rescheduled from before, and we'll also hear from author Kristen Ann on her book, Exploring Sacred Space. And following Friday, March 30th, we'll have musical guest Michael Garfield. And also, I think we'll have Baker on as our interview.
Yep, have Baker back on. And then on April 6th, we're going to have Balsam, which is Sibley Pershat. And she is loveandrespect.info. And we're going to be playing some of her music. And she also has friendlyolds.biz. She talks about essential oils, nature's powerful healers. And also, she put together a CD that puts you directly in touch with nature. And also has a blog about human-nature collaboration as a pathway to enlivenment, vitality, and massive creativity. So check that out.
And as always, you can check out EvolverPlanetRadio.com and Evolver.net and RealitySandwich.com for all the articles and Sporcity updates that we're talking about here. And you can also stream our archive at EvolverPlanetRadio.com.
And for all the new listeners out there, if you're not familiar with the Evolver Network, Evolver is a new social network for conscious collaboration. It provides a platform for individuals, communities, and organizations to discover and share the new tools, initiatives, and ideas that will improve our lives and change in the world in 2012. And with that, good night, Evolver Planet.
Good night, Evolver Planet.